and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the firing of a money laundering specialist at Deutsche Bank who blew the whistle on suspicious activities connected to Donald Trump's and Jared Kushner's accounts involving recent transactions. In response to revelations from Tammy McFadden in the New York Times, Trump has been issuing a tirade of tweets today, blaming it all on the failing New York Times and fake news. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist specializing in global banking and tax havens, who is the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative news service DCReport.org and the author of Blood Bankers, joins us to discuss these latest revelations following a recent examination of Trump's taxes and business records, which indicate he is possibly Wall Street's biggest loser and probably the worst businessman in recent memory. Since Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank goes back decades during a period when Trump's multiple bankruptcies had Wall Street banks refusing to do business with him, we will assess why Trump's supporters still believe his campaign rhetoric that he is such a successful businessman he will make America great again. But according to the New York Times expose, Goldman Sachs at one point used Trump as an example for new employees of precisely the kind of prospective client they should avoid. Then we'll go to Austria to speak with Christian Schuller, who covers Austrian politics for Austria's public radio network ORF, about the firing of the vice chancellor and leader of the far-right Freedom Party, Heinz Christian Strache, by the chancellor, who had joined in a coalition with him, saying that he would civilize the party founded by ex-Nazis. We'll discuss the impact of the video in which Strache offers to sell out Austria to the Russians on Austrian voters ahead of the European elections and more widely across Europe, where there is a fear far-right parties will get a boost in this week's voting for the EU Parliament. Then finally, we'll assess the validity of arguments in the letter the Justice Department sent to the White House counsel in which the DOJ Office of Legal Counsel asserts that the House Judiciary Committee does not have the power to make former White House counsel Don McGahn testify on Tuesday. Bruce Green, the Louis Stein Chair at Fordham Law School, who is the past chair of the ABA's criminal justice section, joins us to assess why Trump does not want public testimony on TV from the Mueller report's most cited witness. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. A former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's a co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, DCReport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jim. And what do you make of the New York Times stories about whistleblowers inside of Deutsche Bank who tried to alert the bank senior management about suspicious activities involving loans to Donald Trump and to Jared Kushner, and instead of being listened to, they got fired? Trump has been tweeting out furiously today saying that the New York Times is writing phony stories about how I didn't use many banks because they didn't want to do business with me. Wrong. It is because I didn't need money.
Well, he's needed money all his whole life. I mean, it's true that in the 1990s, he caused banks to lose about $11 billion in 4 to 6 bankruptcies that he had, so that Deutsche Bank turned out to be one of the few banks that would lend to him after 1998 or so. And Deutsche Bank was hungry to get into the U.S. market, and they were kind of using their balance sheet as their only weapon, which was, you know, as the largest German bank. So they had a propensity to take risks, and they had a series of episodes in which they started off lending aggressively to Trump properties. 2003 2003-2004, they had an episode where they issued several hundred million dollars of bonds for a casino that he owned, and that went bankrupt within a year, lost all the bond owners. So, you know, Deutsche Bank turned out to stick with him throughout this entire, you know, sort of 20-year period. And this latest episode where suspicious activity reports were filed by a couple Deutsche Bank honest employees who proved to be, you know, held responsible by their managers, because apparently Deutsche Bank has always had this strange relationship with Trump right at the top of the bank, and very senior people involved in approving these loans all along. One of them, now chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, Joseph Ackerman, was chairman of Deutsche Bank from 2004 to 2012, and he approved several of these large transactions with Deutsche Bank. So as of now, Deutsche Bank is still Donald Trump's largest creditor. He owes them about $300 million. And over the years, somewhere north of $3 to $4 billion has been gone through the Trump empire, maybe a little bit more. These latest transactions, it's hard to know. We don't have the details of what was the cause of the episode, but the fact that it occurred relatively recently, 2015 and 16, is a signal that Trump didn't change his ways and that he was still relying, you know, we think heavily on this compliant bank to facilitate transactions. Jared Kushner had already come to the bank by way of a private banker who served both of them, Rosemary Vrlabic, who had joined Deutsche Bank in 2006, and she was handling private wealth side for both Kushner and for Donald Trump, and sort of managing their personal portfolios, but also got pretty deeply involved in making loans to Trump. I mean, it's kind of unusual that she was actually facilitating in 2012. She facilitated a transaction where the private wealth side actually ended up lending Trump money to pay back the investment side of the bank, at a time in which the investment side of the bank, investment banking side, had basically given up on Trump as a productive client. You know, you have the wealth side come in and say, no, no, we want to keep him because he's got all his money with us. So, you know, there's two congressional committees now that have subpoenaed documents from Deutsche Bank, the Maxine Waters, Financial Services, and Schiff's Intelligence Committee in the House. Trump is resisting those documents and has opposed releasing information on, you know, sort of privacy grounds. But we may well get to the bottom of this if we can get Deutsche Bank to actually have to appear before Congress and testify about what their relationship consists of.
Well, would that involve the whistleblower testifying, the one that got fired?
Well, that would be possible. You know, it depends on, you know, a lot of things. But I think it's conceivable that the right congressional hearing could produce some real fireworks here. I think it's not out of the realm of possibility. So far, you know, I've been disappointed in the Congress' ability to kind of get to the bottom of this stuff, and there isn't really a kind of Senator Levin, you know, permanent investigations committee type quality to the investigations that have gone on. You know, if Levin were still around, he was a senator from Michigan who retired in 2014, I think. If he were around, he would have Deutsche Bank senior executives up before Congress and raking them over the coals about this stuff, no question about it.
Well, but the Democrats don't control the Senate, so they couldn't.
No, that's true. I mean, the Permanent Investigations Committee has gone into a deep sleep since he retired and since they lost control of the Senate. So, you know, that's one of the things we're missing in this investigative panoply here. You know, I think Deutsche Bank is probably the most important financial institution involved with Trump, at least in the U.S. market. We've seen there's, you know, there's nothing other really comparable among any other bank. So, and they have a deep relationship historically with Russia and with, you know, Eastern Bloc countries as well, in Austria. They were recently involved in the Danske Bank scandal. They've got a lot of cases where they've been implicated in turning a blind eye, at the very least, to high-level money laundering. So, you know, their stock has taken a plummeting as these problems kind of linger on. They tried to have a merger with Commerce Bank recently, which cratered. And so the bank is really in you know, for a prominent German bank, it's really kind of on the ropes here.
Well, there's a conservative author who wrote a book recently, Everything That Trump Touches Dies. So it sounds like Deutsche Bank's yet another example of that. Again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. You mentioned the Danske Bank. This is the Danish bank whose branch in Estonia funneled $230 billion of money out of Russia. And CBS's 60 Minutes ran a piece about it on Sunday. It's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think about it? And, of course, Putin's cousin was one of the people involved. That is...
Well, it underscores the fact that money laundering is really a kind of national security problem. We have, in the EU in particular, they have what's called an anti-money laundering regulation, but it isn't really doesn't establish common policies across the member states, and so you had German officials taking it for granted that Estonia, another member of the EU, and Denmark would surely not be permitting nefarious practices because they're members of the EU. But in fact, this is a case of where a single correspondent bank that was operating in Estonia was basically able to, drive a gigantic truck through the loopholes involved in the EU money laundering regulations. And so that's just, it turns out that when you look closely at money laundering enforcement in Europe, I mean, Germany and the Eastern Bloc, former Eastern Bloc members, are some of the biggest loopholes in the system. And this is just an example of where that, went into play, where a lot of money coming out of Russia was being laundered directly through these European correspondent banks.
But why do you think it is that the public simply can't get their head around, particularly Trump supporters, although I don't think they read the New York Times, but still the idea that there's recent revelations about his business and how he's the biggest loser, probably in American financial history. At least in 1 year, he lost $1 billion. So why doesn't that penetrate? I mean, the banks in the Wall Street banks blackball him because of this string of bankruptcies involving casinos. Normally, the house wins in a casino, so it's hard to believe that you could actually bankrupt a casino. Then, of course, the Plaza Hotel, the Trump airline, and all this other stuff. And then, according to the New York Times, Goldman Sachs at one point used Donald Trump as an example for new employees of precisely the kind of prospective client they should avoid.
I think we have a problem with understanding the folks who are Trump supporters. Basically, they at some level don't care about his lack of performance as a business guy. They see him as an iconoclast, as someone who's sticking it to the system, who's an outsider, who is willing to share a lot of their, sort of questionable values on subjects like immigrants and women and, racism. I mean, there's a certain level at which they connect with all that, and I think it makes them cloud over when they think about the details of his actual performance. It's not clear to me that Trump has said himself, you could shoot someone on Madison Avenue and a lot of people wouldn't care. So, you know, this is not unique to the United States. We have a global movement here for, you know, sort of, some people call it populism. I think it's that's a little soft. We have a fairly authoritarian movement going on across borders. And so if you look at someone like Bolsonaro in Brazil, you find a similar history, you know, of not a very successful business guy who's got all kinds of wild ideas and is quite militant in his rhetoric. Then he has a loyal following because he's viewed as someone who's going to shake the system. You know, they're resentful of the fact that the Democrats were in power for 8 years under Obama and promised change and kind of, you know, looked the other way at the immiseration of the middle class in this country. A lot of people who were, you know, looking to the Democrats for leadership on issues like, you know, reforming Wall Street, you know, cleaning up the banks, having a fairer tax system, didn't get that from the Obama administration. So I think there's a lot of frustration and really kind of legitimate sort of
right.
skepticism about the elite.
Sure, but
that's the sort of the transnational basis for this movement is, mm-hmm. has got what we have to take into account. It isn't just about clinging to Trump.
Right, but people, the very people you're talking about who voted for Trump were attracted to his candidacy because he said, I'm a successful businessman, I'm not a politician, and I'll do for you guys what I did for in terms of my successful businesses. Well, that's a complete lie. He's an absolutely appalling businessman. He's one of the world's worst businessmen. And
yeah,
second thing he emphasized is, I'm so rich, I don't need to raise money like all these other politicians. Remember, he shamed them all in the Republican primary debates. You know, you all take money, and he says, some of you take money from me, and I write the checks. That really appealed to people, and of course, it turns out that he's not taking care of these people that voted for him. He's taking care of the billionaires. So, you know, he's just a massive fraud, this guy.
Yeah, it's true. And the more you look at the people in his administration are kind of helping himself to, you know, their positions in power. I mean, the latest example I know of is the Secretary of Transportation, who's been, you know, sort of in cabinet meetings recently sort of complaining about reforming the Jones Act because, you know, it appears her family has a big shipping business. So,
and she's, you know, married to Mitch McConnell, right?
Married to Mitch McConnell, a man not without influence in this administration, but she's sort of single-handedly holding up, you know, an effort to, you know, reform, I think probably a reasonable reform to, you know, to relax the constraints that we have on, you know, non-U.S. shipping. But it's doing it for personal reasons, you know, so that's kind of, you know, outrageous. But we've seen that again and again. Within the administration, it's got to be one when the story is told about all these the side deals that have been done here. It's going to be, you know, much more than Trump. It's
right
implicated, I think.
Right, and Elaine Chao's job at Transportation is to oversee the FAA, and she totally failed with Boeing, and now Boeing, one of America's most successful companies, is totally trapped because they've got this complete turkey of a plane. The 737 MAX, which is unsafe. And the Department of Transportation did absolutely no oversight. Let Boeing test its own aircraft and the cockpit equipment that's turned out to be so catastrophic.
That's right. I mean, you know, she's just one great example of this. I mean, the Coast Guard recently had to award a $750 million contract to an outfit in Panama City to build a icebreakers at a time when the Norway was offering the United States, you know, basically access to all their technology and experience at 25% of the cost of icebreakers. Now, why does this Panama City company get awarded this contract? Well, clearly there's something going on, and Elaine Chao is not doing her job. But you know, there's I mean, David K. Johnson and I have been writing about this. It's kind of a from one standpoint, a field day for investigative journalists. We've never had such an abundance of riches. But the issue is, you know, how many times can you go back to the barrel and go fishing? Because it's just so many fish in the barrel.
Right. Well, but, you know, there's nothing funny about it. The joke's on us. We're all getting screwed. The whole country's being screwed by this team of grifters.
One of the concerns I have on the macro level is right now with this China policy. You know, that we're assuming that Trump knows what he's doing in terms of deal doing when it comes to China. But it's getting to – people are starting to realize that if we implement a 25% tariff on China – they're not going to have a really good business reason to want the United States economy to be supported. They have about $1.1 trillion of U.S. debt that they hold. And if they, let's say, start selling that off, even though it's only about 5% of the total, on the margin it can make a huge difference. So if they conclude that there's no longer a stake that China has in the profitability of the U.S. economy, we're going to see higher interest rates. We're going to see potentially, quite an impact on the U.S. economy from that. I don't think people have really priced that in to the stock market yet, but he's definitely playing with fire. And this is based on this kind of, you know, the more you know about his deal-making history, the more concern you have, because you realize he's been shooting from the hip for, you know, for 30, 40 years.
And but for dirty Russian money, he would have been finished long ago.
Well, and for, you know, I mean, he has a lot of authors, co-authors. I mean, the deal that the FBI cut with Felix Sater back in 1998 basically, you know, facilitated his going off and raising money for Trump, for the Trump Soho, and from lots of dubious sources. You know, so there were mistakes made along the way by people in both parties and sort of all kinds of backgrounds, but you know, this is more than just a single individual who's had corruption. He's had a lot of enablers over the years, and I think that's the story of that network is really, you know, the essence of Trump. He couldn't have done what he has been able to do without a lot of complicity from institutions like Deutsche Bank.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's a co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Austria to talk about the firing of the vice chancellor and leader of the far-right Freedom Party.
Lands were down pretty well so far. But when they see the kind of person that you really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing so hard.
Cola, he said, I know you. You know me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Austria is Christian Schuller, who's a reporter and correspondent currently based in Austria, who for the last 5 years reported from Turkey and Iran for Austrian TV network ORF, and he now covers Austrian politics on Austrian public radio network ORF. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christian Schuller.
Hello.
So, Christian, there's been quite an upset in your country just ahead of the European elections, which start on Thursday. The Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, the leader of the Austrian People's Party, called for snap elections following the resignation of Heinz Christian Strache, his vice-chancellor and head of the far-right Freedom Party. And now, of course, following that, the Freedom Party's interior minister has been dismissed in a corruption scandal. Is that a separate scandal from the one that Strache had to resign over?
No. It's the same thing. it's the same thing. The idea, the reasoning, is that given that there's a lot to investigate about donations to the Freedom Party, maybe donations from the Russian side to this Austrian Nationalist Party, this has to be investigated, and it's difficult to imagine how this should be investigated as long as the Interior Minister is also part of this rightist party. So that was the reason why the Austrian Chancellor said we can only go on and investigate this matter if we change the Interior Ministry. And as a result of this, other members of the Freedom Party resigned, like in solidarity with the Interior Minister.
So to go back to Strache's resignation, it was because a two-year-old video surfaced from Der Spiegel in Germany showing Strache offering government contracts and a stake in one of Austria's largest newspapers in exchange for Russian support for his party. Now, my understanding is that Kurz brought the Freedom Party into his coalition thinking that he could, quote, civilize the party, which was founded by ex-Nazis and has been quite racist and anti-Semitic in its rhetoric. That doesn't seem like it worked.
No, this is now the result and the way this crisis is analyzed in Austria and also in other European countries where these Austrian developments have been followed very closely, that this political gamble of Sebastian Kurz to try to bring this nationalist party into the government and to civilize it, as you said, this just didn't work. And it was also very clear from the beginning to most of the observers that it couldn't work, because almost every day something happened in Austria which was ironically called the so-called individual cases, because whenever there was a scandal involved with the Nationalist Party involved, their spokesman said, yes, but this was only an individual case. And those individual cases included cases of racist Nazi postings and declarations by members of the Nationalist Party, links to the Identitarians, which is a clearly neo-Nazi organization, and many members of the Freedom Party have links that have been discovered to these Identitarians. Strache himself, who just recently had used the language, the racist language of the Identitarians, saying that a population exchange was going on in Europe, which he meant to say by this that the migrants who were coming to Europe are kind of extinguishing the local population. And it's exactly the same rhetoric as the terrorist of the Christchurch had used. So there were a lot of incidents. And whenever an incident happened, the Freedom Party said, well, it's just an exception, and the Chancellor usually would keep silence. And now after 18 months, it finally became clear that it was not possible to have this Nationalist Party in the government and expecting that it would change its way of thinking, its rhetorics, or its practice.
And again, I'm speaking with Christian Schuller, who's a reporter and correspondent currently based in Austria, who for the last 5 years reported from Turkey and Iran for Austrian's TV network ORF, and he now covers Austrian politics on Austria's public radio network ORF. So just to touch on what Strache was caught on this two-year-old video, with this attractive Russian woman who said she was a niece of an oligarch and offered up 250 yeah. million euros. Now, of course, he's gone and made a public apology, not for selling his country out to the Russians, but for his behavior, claiming he was drunk and the girl was really pretty and he was kind of flirting with her. And then he had to apologize to his wife because...
Yeah, this was really like a soap opera, you know, like an episode of a soap opera. When Strache appeared on TV, first, not acknowledging any wrong, but attacking those who are criticizing him or who had produced this video, and then apologizing, but mainly apologizing to his wife.
Well, it shouldn't come as a surprise, though. Strikers' Party, the Freedom Party, have a formal coalition agreement with Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party, just as the right-wing League Party of Salvini's in Italy has the same agreement. And, of course, Marine Le Pen's National Front in France received a loan of 9 million euros from a Kremlin-linked Russian bank. And Viktor Orban, of course, of Hungary, openly admires Putin and he imitates his government style because, you know, he's a kleptocrat, Orban, just like Putin is, and operates through a front of oligarchs. So that's happening wide in Europe right up to this critical election starting on Thursday. Will this scandal in Austria blunt the rise of these far-right parties who want to get a one-third vote in the parliament in order to essentially paralyze the European Parliament, which, of course, serves the interests of Vladimir Putin?
Well, nobody can really predict the impact of this scandal, the direct impact on the elections. The newest survey in Austria showed that, yes, the Freedom Party lost a few votes, but not tremendously as would have been expected. But I think it has an effect, though. It will have an effect, though, because it came as a clear warning to other centrist or center conservative governments who would flirt with the idea of having a coalition with a right wing. And so the Austrian example kind of shows to all those who already expected it, but also to the others, that this is a really dangerous game. And I think in this sense, it will have an effect. On the European elections, nobody knows. Anyway, those elections are not very popular, so there will not be a huge turnout, and one could expect that maybe the right-wing voters in Austria, at least, would kind of stay at home, or some of them. But this will not have an effect in Italy, nor will it have an effect in France. Already, those right-wing politicians kind of very quickly took a distance from Strache, even Marine Le Pen, who had admired him for so long. So they said that's a local Austrian affair, that's not our business. So I don't think it will influence the overall result of the European elections.
Well, already Nigel Farage, the architect of Brexit, who represents a right-wing British party in the European Parliament, which is kind of an irony given his attitude to Europe, he's ahead in the polls in the UK. And I don't know how the AfD is doing in Germany. Do you have any information on how the AfD is doing in the polls?
Well, I mean, the case of Germany is insofar interesting as Germany may be the only country that is really interesting in what is going on in Austria and that is following closely those events. But the voters, the potential voters of the AfD, I think, are not at all shocked by what happened here. Because, in fact, one of the roots of those movements, like the AfD and also the Freedom Party in Austria, is a very deep cynicism about the political system. So those people would say, well, all politicians are corrupt, all politicians are having deals with other countries and involving money and black money and so on. So they are not really kind of shocked or surprised to see this kind of event taking place. Those people are already so far away from the mainstream or from the center or from the system, as they call it, that this is clearly not something that can influence them. You have to think that these people also are driven by a feeling of being persecuted by the media and by the system. And here again, So the narrative is to say, not to say Strache did something terrible or what a terrible person he is, but that this shows again how the media or other organizations are trying to trap us. And so it can have a boomerang effect on those right-wing voters.
Well, it is extraordinary that it's come to this, that a German TV and newspapers, it looks like it was a video sting operation, as they say. The Russian woman turned out to be a Latvian. It looks like a setup. But prior to that, we all saw Putin show up at the wedding in Austria for the
yes.
foreign minister, dancing with her, etc. That was pretty suspicious. When this coalition government took over with Kurz and Strache, the intelligence services were raided. We don't know what happened to all of the intelligence dossiers and documents, whether they ended up in the hands of Russia. But what did happen was that the Western intelligence stopped cooperating with Austria, which is pretty extraordinary, to ostracize Austria in that way. And we've seen our own president just recently host Orban in the White House. Nobody wants to go near him, except Trump praised him in ways that were just quite disturbing. And then, you know, Trump's former strategist, Stephen Bannon, is organizing a lot of these right-wing parties and their campaigns, along, and particularly with Salvini, who's working directly with in Italy. So, you know, a lot of people in this country wonder, following the Mueller report, which Trump has refused to release, what the relationship our president has with Putin. Then you look at what Bannon is doing, which is helping Putin, and what all these right-wing parties in Europe are doing, which is helping Putin. And you just wonder, why are these people so enamored with Putin? Why does Strache and the foreign minister love Putin? What's going on?
Well, first of all, there's this authoritarian style of Putin that is, of course, kind of a model for politicians who don't really want to deal with the media or with the public in a democratic way. So in this case, it could also be Erdogan, but then who could be the model, but it cannot be Erdogan because he's a Muslim, and so Putin is a non-Muslim Erdogan, you could argue. But on the other hand, of course, there is I think very astute strategy of the Russian government. For now, for many years, they have really developed links to those parties. This is not something that just appeared this week or last year or a few years ago. They did it. I think that the strategy of the Kremlin to try to weaken the European Union by trying to support all those forces that are kind of fighting the concept of a political union. This is a very old strategy, and I think we have still not discovered. It's not even the tip of the iceberg that we have seen so far.
Well, there's an old expression: "United we stand, divided we fall." So
yeah.
There is
yeah.
I just talked to a British author, Oliver Bullock, the other day. He's got a new book called Moneyland. And he made the case that a part of Putin's motive to weaken Western Europe, to atomize the EU instead of uniting it, to divide it, is to make it weaker so that there can't be any multinational efforts to stop money laundering, for example, which is what Putin has apparently stole. He's got at least $160 billion in his own name stashed abroad. And just one branch of a Danish bank in Estonia laundered $230 billion for the Russians. So that seems to be a pretty cynical motive.
Of course, this could, but I think this is only one of the motives. There's also the other one, more logical maybe, is that Russia doesn't want to have a united foreign policy of the European Union. And so all efforts that could lead to a kind of more cooperation or coordination between Europeans is might at some point bother the Russian interests, in the Russian global interests. By the way, I also think that besides Russian interests in dividing Europe, and besides the admiration of those authoritarian Europeans for an authoritarian regime like Russia, there's also some affinity in the values, in conservative values. So there is this idea that the family should the family should still be the most important cell of society. Everything that weakens the family is kind of a threat to society. Weakening the family, like Orban keeps saying, weakening the family means that there's not enough children, and therefore we have to resort to have migrants from elsewhere. So there is this ideology of what we call in Germany Blut und Boden, so about that the local population has to kind of to stay firm by conserving the old institutions or coming back to old institutions. This is something that's going on in Russia, and it's going on also in Europe. So kind of trying to reverse the old modern trend, all trends of modern life, of modern society.
Absolutely. There's no question that, and that is Stephen Bannon's affection for Russian authoritarianism, is that it's the last stand of the white Christian man. Mentioned earlier that Strzok's followers were using that far right wing and neo-Nazi trope of white genocide. The idea that
exactly.
whites are under threat. So we see that over here amongst the far right-wing groups that for some reason or other our own president, Donald Trump, simply cannot criticize. So just in closing, I hope you can offer some optimism here with these elections starting on Thursday. What's your prediction of how well the far right will do? Is there any way to stop their momentum, and has what's happening in Austria perhaps embarrass them a little, one would hope?
Well, I'm not sure about these elections. I think the right wing will be very successful this time. But in the long run, there's also a lot of conflict, of course, which is logical between nationalist movements. Even if they try to form alliances, there is a lot of conflict between them. If you take the example of Poland, the Polish government party would be a very strong force in this European nationalist movement. But the problem is that Poland doesn't like to be close to Russia. So the Polish nationalists, for this reason, don't join this movement of Strache and Orban and Salvini. In the same way. So there's a lot of contradictions between those nationalists. And I think it's not what happened in Austria is kind of a first sign of showing that those movements are also so much contradictory internally and brought together only by aggression against the so-called system, but in fact, they are not very strong movements. Because when you see now, for instance, in this the Freedom Party, the reactions of the leading politicians, there was such a strong thirst for power to get the post of Strache, to get his position. So there's a lot of aggression inside those movements. This is logical because those are Führer movements who are brought together by one strong figure, And this creates a lot of frustration at the same time. And so those people are destroying themselves. They have a kind of suicidal element also in them. This happened in France for at one moment. No, if you remember this battle between the two Le Pen daughter and father and the violence the violence of those battles.
Right.
So I think this is a tendency that we will see once they come close to power they cannot hold their aggression anymore.
Sure. Well, just in closing though, I'm trying to look for some optimism here. I love the idea of the grannies, the grandmothers in Austria that are the antithesis of Strache. They are peaceful social democratic movement. They're trying to revive traditional Austrian values in the more virtuous sense as opposed to the far right neo-Nazi kind of specter. So how's that movement doing, the granny movement?
The granny movement is doing very well. They're getting stronger and stronger. And last Saturday, they were kind of like the nucleus of a huge spontaneous demonstration against the government and against the right-wing party. But it was not only the grandmothers. Also, there were a lot of cafes in Vienna that served champagne for free to everybody just because they were celebrating the end of Strache and the end of the nationalists.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christian Schuller.
Bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Christian Schuller, who's a reporter and correspondent currently based in Austria, who for the last 5 years reported from Turkey and Iran for Austrian's TV network, ORF. He now covers Austrian politics on Austria's public radio network, ORF. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the validity of the arguments in a letter to the Justice Department sent to the White House counsel, asserting that the House Judiciary Committee does not have the power to make former White House counsel Don McGahn testify tomorrow.
Well, I'm gonna tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bruce Green, the Louis Stein Chair at Fordham Law School and the Director of the Louis Stein Center for Law and Ethics, where his main area of focus are legal ethics and criminal law. He's the past chair of the ABA Criminal Justice Section, and his article, Can the President Control the Department of Justice, co-authored with Rebecca Royfe, is available at the Alabama Law Review. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Green.
Thanks.
So what do you make of the letter from the DOJ basically saying that Don McGahn can't testify tomorrow, Tuesday, before the House Judiciary Committee?
Well, it doesn't really say he can't testify. It says Congress can't make him testify, and that if the president wants, the president can refuse to make him available. It's interesting that because it's relying on a principle that hasn't really been discussed very much. Most of the discussion has been about executive privilege, which is the idea that the president can keep certain communications with his advisors confidential. And, you know, I think the Congress's assumption was that the president couldn't rely on executive privilege with respect to his conversations with Don McGahn, because Mr. McGahn had talked to the Mueller team for hours and hours, and presumably, as the Mueller report reflected, was talking about his communications with Trump. And so, you know, the ordinary nature of privileges like the executive privilege is that they can be waived. And once you disclose what was communicated, you've pretty much waived or given up the privilege. But interestingly, the memo was talking about a completely different concept that I don't think people have been talking about, which is the idea of this, they call it testimonial immunity, the idea that folks who are in the president's inner circle are immune from being compelled by Congress to testify, even if they've already voluntarily talked about exactly the same things to somebody else. And the memo is actually, it's pretty long. It's 15 single-spaced pages, and it's pretty interesting because what it shows is that the executive branch, the president, has, it's not, you know, Donald Trump didn't invent the idea. Presidents have been asserting for a long time that Congress can't drag their senior advisors to Congress to testify, that they only, you know, can testify voluntarily with the president's consent. And the opinion gives a lot of examples of that. But it's a little short on judicial authority. And so it appears that in the past, whenever the executive branch asserted this position, generally Congress would either acquiesce or more likely they'd just work it out. They'd come up with some resolution where the advisor would talk off the record or talk voluntarily and limit the scope of what they talk about, etc. And so there are apparently a few cases where Congress has gone to court, and the court has not been on the president's side in these cases. But nevertheless, the executive branch, the Department of Justice, has pretty consistently, it appears, taken the position, which is not too surprising, that the president can control whether the senior inner circle people can be compelled by Congress to testify about their dealings with the president. It's pretty interesting, I think.
Well, Bruce Green, in the Mueller report, Don McGahn is the most cited witness, 157 times. And it seems to me that what's going on here is that the president doesn't seem to mind what testimony goes on in depositions, nor particularly in the Mueller report itself, since he's already bottled it up and not releasing the full report to the public or the Congress. And I think Barr and he have done a good job of muting its and blunting its impact, and most people haven't read it. And it turns out Republican Congressman Justin Amash read it and in its entirety, and then decided that to go public and say that he thought that that Trump had committed impeachable offenses, and which has irritated the hell out of Trump. But the long and the short of it is, I think Trump recognized the damage that Michael Cohen's public testimony did before Congress, and he simply doesn't want this happening on television because he realizes that has a much more powerful impact. What's your sense of the tactics going on here?
I do think if there was ever a case where the assertion of this testimonial privilege is tactical, it's this case. I mean, obviously, you know, the theory of the privilege or the immunity is that you know, the president is co-equal with Congress, and Congress shouldn't be able to just drag executive branch folks in front of it and make it look like they're subordinate. But I mean, whatever the rationale is for it, given that McGahn has given tons of information to Mueller's team, it can't be that The president is worried that there's been something, highly sensitive that McGahn might spill the beans about. Obviously, there's probably very little that he hasn't already said. And so I do think you can draw the pretty strong inference that this is all about appearances, that it's, the president doesn't want, somebody, a visual, and, so Don McGahn, who's going to repeat maybe what he said already, but have it get out into the public in a way that the many hundred-page Mueller report, didn't get out there. But on the other hand, Congress is also engaged in a somewhat visual or political or atmospheric sort of enterprise. Do they think that they're going to learn something from McGahn that they didn't already learn from the Mueller report, or is it just as a way of getting on the news some of the stuff that people kind of overlooked because the Mueller report was so darn long? A little politics on both sides,
sure,
I think.
Sure, but do you think that McGahn could testify and get around the White House's claims? Could he sort of update things and not talk about specifics what went on, but talk about how things look to him now in retrospect? I mean, is there a way you can thread that needle?
Well, if you accept the Justice Department theory, unless he's talking about his completely private stuff and not talking about his interactions with the president, then he can't be forced to testify. Not even if he voluntarily, personally wanted to testify, it's really up to the president and not to McGahn. That's the Justice Department theory. So it doesn't turn really on the content of what he has to say. It's just that if they're going to ask him about his official work with the president as part of the inner circle, he can't be compelled. I mean, I really think, in the end of the day, at some point Congress is going to just have to decide whether it wants to go to court over some of this stuff. I doubt very much that the president is going to negotiate or accede on this issue. I don't think he has any incentive to do that. I don't think McGahn can thread the needle, as you suggest. It really has, if it's going to get resolved with him testifying, it's going to have to involve a court action.
Well, but if you take this theory in this letter writ large, every senior government official writes a book, don't they? About what happened. This is like a kill shot for the memoirs of government, high-level government employees.
Well, that's just to point out how overreaching this whole theory is. But my point is that it's not just Trump's administration who's formulated the theory. But the theory is you can't make us go to Congress. But we can write our books because that doesn't, interfere with the equality of the president, the executive branch vis-a-vis Congress. Writing your tell-all is a completely different thing.
Sure.
Of course it's absurd. And if there's ever a situation where, invoking testimonial immunity makes no sense other than political sense, it's here. But I think that's still in the Justice Department's theory. That's the way this doctrine works.
Well, just in closing, right across the board, though, Trump is refusing subpoenas. He's refusing to the Civil Rights Division was subpoenaed for two questions on the citizenship in the 2020 census. The Secretary of Treasury's been subpoenaed, and he's completely ignoring it, even though there's a law that he's violating. My sense is, again, we're talking about tactics, is that the president's basically, it's like Clint Eastwood, go ahead and make my day. He's more or less saying to the Congress, impeach me, but I'm not going to give you a damn thing.
Well, I think that there's probably other steps to take before you get to impeachment, which can include trying to enforce some of these subpoenas. I'm not sure a subpoena to McGahn would be where they would start. But, you know, they have subpoenas for tax returns and, you know, they're seeking all kinds of other things. And you know, it is a standoff at the moment, but I'm not sure why, you know, Congress, which I think should be standing for the rule of law, doesn't invoke the law and go to the courts.
Well, apparently that may well be Trump's tactic, that to run out the clock. I mean, how long are we talking about? How long can these things be tied up in the courts?
Well, I would think that most judges would expedite this for exactly the reason you point to. I mean, they can put aside, you know, some of their other civil litigation and attend to this right away if they want to.
Well, Bruce Green, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Green, who is the Lewis Stein Chair at Fordham Law School and the Director of the Lewis Stein Center for Law and Ethics, where his main area of focus is legal ethics and criminal law. And he's the past chair of the ABA's Criminal Justice Section. And his article, Can the President Control the Department of Justice, co-authored with Rebecca Royfe, is available at the Alabama Law Review. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.